Over the last decade or so, we've seen some major changes in consumer behavior. Think about it. Our customers went from those clunky landlines and STD booths to sleek smartphones buzzing with 5G. Beyond their pockets, they're now strapping those things onto their wrists as well. Also, for many of us, the monthly large grocery shopping list is a thing of the past in the era of 10-minute deliveries. We're becoming lazier. And how are the brands responding? They're happy to spoil us if we promise them our loyalty. And standing like tall pillars, watching all this action going on are the legacy brands. While the absolute penetration of e-commerce transactions across categories might be still below 10 and 20%, the amount of influence digital channels have on purchase decisions is quite disproportionate. So what's the playbook for them so that they don't remain left behind? A lot of them are getting a digital makeover. They're engaging consultants to revamp how they do business and interact with customers. Technology infrastructure has made a lot of things table stakes. E-com, storefronts, payment gateways, warehouses, and shipping logistics. Where there's a problem, there's a SaaS available to solve it. In fact, there's many. But that's for another conversation. Today's insights are about two stories of digital transformation and what our reading of the playground is. We're blending two different episodes to give you a behind-the-scenes look at how Eureka Forbes and Angel One, two of India's large legacy organizations, tackle the whole subject of digital transformation. Eureka Forbes is a popular consumer brand, and Angel Broking, which is now called Angel One, has been around for a long enough time as a large broking house. Let's call this format Common Threads. You'll hear me chat with Shubham Srivastav, Chief Product and Technology Officer at Eureka Forbes, and Ankit Rastogi, the Chief Product Officer at Angel One. Let's understand at what point of their organization's digital makeover journey they joined at. What was the state of affairs then, and how's it going now?
I would imagine for the scale at which you already operate, digital transformation is going to be a comprehensive and complex exercise. So help us understand, Shubham, that when you were brought in, what was the state of affairs, and now where are you heading towards with respect to the org design, the people, the tech, the data side of things? So we'll get to each of these, but let's just probably start with the org alignment.
Not sure. So from a consumer durable company standpoint, the scope of technology or the scope of digital is largely limited into, you know, most of a third party led intervention, and then standard legacy IT kind of a setup, right? And where you have various vendors working and solving for different sort of problems, etc. Slightly fragmented, slightly disjoint.
The SAP, not, ERP,
so
that side of the world.
The consumer durable industry, and Eureka Forbes that way, was not very different from a standard setup per se. And the right from ERPs, right from different multi-platforms for your sales and services, sure. Some of the platform on consumer offerings, internal CRMs and consolidated ones, all of that. So we're pretty much all over the place in terms of where we are. We are almost 10 months back. Not a lot of that has changed because it's such a significant and a mammoth kind of a setup. So that was somewhere we started with. But what I found very, very clearly that there's a significant amount of digital adoption, intervention to be done to consolidate and build these platforms in a very, very comprehensive, connected, and agile way, which would essentially mean that we would build the core of our product as platforms. And then when I say platforms, I would essentially look at saying that something that you build today should be able to easily extend, flexible to adopt, and ensure that the agility on building and adopting remains, right? Mm. So while that may sound a little more Greek and a little more high level, what it essentially means is that you transform most of these setups into, let's say on the technology world, into a microservices-led technology architecture stack, where you are able to then extend these platforms at different use cases. Mm. But broadly speaking, the idea and intent was to first consolidate larger part of these platform and then change all of that into new age technology tech setup, which can then further be extended, which would essentially means that you build a very robust and a comprehensive connected sales and services platform, a consumer-led platform. And while you're doing all of these, how are you able to leverage the data which is getting collected across all of these interventions, right? So you create a mammoth big data platform, which can then leverage the rightful data, build computation on top of that, leverage that computation power into machine learning models. And then a couple of these interventions can go to from a consumer led interventions, consumer led features or consumer driven features. And a couple of them can then lead into your backend operation, optimizing for your sales and service operations and corresponding. So the idea intent being that you solve and build all of that into core platform capabilities, consolidate most of them, build core platform capabilities, and then extend your features and features, interventions, etc. on top of that.
Sure. Ankit, would be lovely to double click on the whole aspect of Angel Broking being what, a 25-year-old organization, mm-hmm. the promoters deciding that we want to play fintech, in some sense, maybe inspired by all the action that's happening in the digital ecosystem, and then deciding to bring somebody like you on board with the level of mandate to build out this entire organization, right? Mm-hmm. And it's been, what, a 3-year journey?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, absolutely.
How about you just tell us about the initial days of how this played out?
I think this has been quite a challenging ride. I think, as I said, blessed by some more CXO leadership we joined. We had a CEO who came in. We have a CTO. We have a lot of other leaders who have come in. Our entire Bombay leadership has also been fantastically supportive, and they've also looked up to this. But yeah, initial days, it was quite a challenge to hire, for sure.
Of course.
Right. In fact, the tide has completely turned now. I think The number of people we see today who are showing an inward interest mm-hmm. just on our LinkedIn page has scaled humongously, I think. We have been, by the way, just yesterday we were announced as the top 50 in GPTW within the millennial category.
Okay.
So, right. So, I think...
Great place to work, in case you didn't know.
So that, I think, has been a constant evolution. And I think everything has played there right from the people culture. Culturally, we have been a very...
In some sense, Ankit...
Younger place now.
So in some sense, what I tend to see as a struggle with traditional companies trying to go through this whole digital transformation curve is the constant conflict between the legacy mindset, the people who have been around for a while, and those are people who have done technology to the level of the SAPs and the ERPs and whatever systems had been brought in back then. And now when you talk about agile systems and Scrum and all of those kind of things, which are very normal and natural to new economy ecosystem, there's a degree of dissonance. So in some sense, what you're saying is Bombay versus Bangalore. Bangalore is the entire tech space, which means all the people who are brought in here are the ex-Amazon, ex-Uber. So they talk the same language. And these are people you resonate well with as well because you come from a similar background. But there's not as much, let's say, interference or dissonance which is with Bombay in some sense.
To some extent. But I think the one way where we were, I would say, already pro towards tech is that I think the promoter and the board, as we said, that though we were based out of Bombay, I think the utilization of technology to solve the problems, even when we had physical offices, was always there. So that mindset just kind of helped.
Tech first. Okay?
Absolutely. Okay. Whether it was driven by vendors versus in-house team, whether we had some ways to make it work, right? I think we were ahead of the curve that time also. Just that, I think the entire team coming together in-house, okay? And as I said, club with the ecosystem itself booming up. Okay, it was almost like at the right time.
The good tailwinds from the external ecosystem as well.
And I would say the risk appetite, right? That and the trust the entire management kind of trusted with us. And for example, we took the decision of just changing our app. Okay, that was one of the largest ever migrations we did when I joined in 2.5 years back. Still, we had close to 1 million DAU. Today, we are blessed with 2 million plus. Probably it was slightly less than 1 million. Okay. And we were at that time had just started the migration. I will not say I had started, but we were still thinking. But with this talent coming in house, product, tech, data, MarTech, right, and our business team getting revamped. So I think all this helped us to fast track that. And we were, at that time, there was a very interesting problem, which I would like to discuss here, that we had this dilemma that should we go into a two-app migration? You can continue the old one and should we have a second Play Store listing? Versus should we migrate all on the same app ID, which is like classic market problem, right? You have your SEOs, you have your campaigns. We took the risk that, and we had, by the way, examples without naming the competition where the two apps were running and they were running for quite some time.
Sure.
Okay, and there is always a philosophy that you can gradually shift the entire traffic on the other side, including the discovery of the app, right? But we took a punt that one app will work. That will give us, it will be risky, but then we'll put all our thrust on one. That will ensure that there's no backups. Okay. We did this trial with beta almost for a year. It was not like that the second app was not there, but it was in beta.
Call it as much a punt then.
But the main app in production on the day was almost like just one.
Sure.
It was never like you didn't had. So we had obviously some loyal customers whom we had to have some teething troubles, because you were not just changing the skin of the app, right? We were also doing the entire backend changes. We have ruggedized, in technical language, the stability. We followed a principle we followed in, generally we use a lot in STARS, STARS, simplicity, transparency, availability, reliability, and swiftness.
Okay.
Okay. And you will hear them in a lot of our blogs and all our stories, right? So we were, these were the core crux of everything which we were doing, right? So the app used to be, while we were transforming, it has to be simplified, okay?
Of course.
It has to be made more transparent in our domain, how much trade and charges are impacted, sure. Right? What are we doing with your money? Has to be extremely
transparent. It's a very trust-driven category.
Absolutely. Right? The availability itself is a big question, right? You have put in a trade and suddenly, right?
Then, right. Very sensitive.
Absolutely. It has to be a very tactile feedback on the app, right? The reliability itself, right? You can't go down, right? You are playing with, obviously, again, with
serious transactions. Of course, point of time.
And then the speed. So all this, I think, this is a classic example, I think, where this new team was able to deliver that. And now I think that has become a benchmarker.
Often, when a tech or product leader joins a legacy organization, they face a lot of challenges in A, training traditional employees to adopt new systems, B, hiring experts to lead specific aspects. Now, let's explore how these two tech leaders are navigating this question mark.
So Shubham, you made a transition rather from a digital native kind of play at MakeMyTrip and then intermittently at HD Digital Streams and then now at a legacy organization. From just the DNA of a tech savvy versus a legacy organization, there's a big change, right? And the people side of things can sometimes become the first thing to solve for.
Yeah.
Right? So the fact that they brought you in automatically meant that they have a certain level of confidence and commitment to the topic. How did you then go about solving the people side of things and the culture, the people bringing in new talent? How's that journey?
No, very good question. I think this also something as a continuous learning I'm dealing with and trying to make the best out of it. But I'll just break it down into two parts. So one is that there's an existing team who's a quantum of knowledge. So first you have to have the right level of interaction with them to ensure that they are completely committed and aligned to the cause, right? So I think what happens most of the time is that as a new leader, when you enter, you are a threat to all of those people saying that, yeah, bahar se aaya bachcha, what he's going to tell me? Yeah. We are here for like 25, 30 years. He's coming and giving us some gyan, this, that. And which, to all rightfulness, is correct. I don't know any part of that, right? I mean, sure. These guys are there running the show and all of it. So I think the first and foremost thing would be that how do you first get that level of trust and enablement with the team going so that they feel comforted, they are aligned to the cause, and they also understand the bigger picture. The important thing that I've done at my initial multiple weeks and town halls and then the one-on-one discussions that I have with the team is to say that, look, this is exactly what we are alluding towards. This is what exactly we want and why, right? And of course, then start taking them along, saying that, now tell me, if this is the problem statement, what exactly will be your way to solve for it, right? So hear from them and align them in terms of the solution that they are proposing. And most of the time, when you get things right, when you tell them the rightful details on what sort of problem, why the solution would not have this level of capability down the line, immediately, et cetera, they start understanding your perspective. And then over a period, they will start resembling more towards your goal, et cetera. Now, all of that is not going to happen in a transaction. For sure. So you will have the initial level of resistance and challenges and whatnot, right? I mean, end of the day, all of us are people. We have emotions. We have the right way to... We have ways and means of dealing with the situation, right? Yeah. End of the day. The second part, which is the most interesting and most complex part, is the hiring part. Now, hiring, again, I have the liberty of hiring multiple people, leaders, etc. And I think I've been hiring for the last 6-7 months now across roles. I'm finding the engineering leads, I'm finding the product leads, I'm finding the data engineers, automation, all of that. And of course, IT person, et cetera, as well. I'm able to hire 6 people by now. Yeah? Just 6. Yes. Yeah?
How many do you look out?
I think I would have interviewed somewhere around, if I'm not wrong, I think I would have interviewed somewhere around 350, 400 people.
So your funnel is very sharp. And how many positions do you have to start with?
I started with somewhere around... I think we had a lot of positions initially open, but I just when I looked at it, I said, boss, hoga nahi. So let's look at a sharper set of 10, 12, 15 people and just get them aligned first. So I was trying to build the leaders, at least leaders who are at a hands-on level, leaders who are not coming at a right. You get what I'm saying, right?
So
I want leaders who are at a hands-on level, who are able to, you know, roll up the sleeve, get this stuff, and get that going. So I was able to hire a very, very less, and that was also a choice. I wanted to have a very lean, sharp team, just to be, so that I can work them at an individual level and also show them the impact, right? So if you as an individual comes and start driving one part of the greenfield project, and this is also, I'm going to talk about how it helps me to hire people with that level of alignment of what they want to do in terms of working on a maintenance kind of project versus the greenfield project. So if you give somebody a project which is more greenfield, building grounds up, building in a building in a vision that it can align and give it, let's say, X million customers visibility over, let's say, 1 to 3 years. I think these are a couple of sharper things that some of these leaders aligned, and that's where they were able to, we were able to hire, and of course, they're doing great. So in totality, from a digital team hiring per se, I think my learning was you can't just hire anyone. You just can't hire people from Amazon, Flipkart, or I'm not saying that, I mean, it's difficult to hire, but you're just not able to hire just like another company, right? And of course, these are best of the talents and best of the talent in the world now, right? Not just India. So there are going to be 2-3 ways in which you can you know, do that. I think when I do my discussions, of course, I do a shortlisting and all of that. And given that the first round, the second round, and the last round, all was my round, right? So there was no one literally to kind of do those rounds, right? So, and I found what I found initially is that the very first deck or very first presentation that I created was the presentation I created for my folks who I'm going to hire. So when I used to do the interviews, I have to first take them along saying that, look, for 30 minutes, 20 to 30 minutes, I know I would have bored them like hell, but for 20 to 30 minutes, I used to just give them the larger picture. Ki boss, company hai, kharab company hai, maan ke chalo, digital company nahi hai, right? And there's no second ways about it. I also equally think ki digital nahi hai to nahi hai. Matlab, I can't, just because I'm hiring you, I can't say that's a digital company. This digital ka D nahi hai yahan pe, right? So now, but this is what we have to offer. This is what we are going to build. Ye rahega tech stack, ye rahega problem statement, ye rahega iska outcome, right? And then talk them through the specifics of that. So I think the rudimentary way of hiring was all saying define the 9 to 12, 15, 18, this, that. But now when I look at what I would have started with a 12 to 18 year is now shifted to 4 to maybe a 6 to 7 years. Yeah, because I'm able to get that talent. I'm able to get that person and he's equally aligned. So a person who comes and works with me directly or let's say leads one of these products and has a 4 to 5 or 6 year experience, look at the kind of exposure he gets. And of course, he'll be accountable. He'll be having the rightful skill as well. We'll do that competency level test. But as an individual, he also gets such a massive exposure and he drives all of that greenfield project. So I think just to summarize on the digital hiring part, I think we have to break the standard rudimentary ways of hiring. You have to look out for bright chaps, forget the experience to a reasonable extent. I know we are still a corporate, so we still have to, you know, have that level of zigzag with the HR saying that, boss, ye to. But we'll be able to solve for it. But I think my broader summary would be that break some predefined notions, get the rightful people.
You have now these new hires, which are probably 5 years mature, and then you have those people who've been around for like a long time. How does this team now gel together into a single cohesive force?
See, I think the couple of things that you need to intervene and create a structure around. I think the first and foremost is do some sort of a formal town hall, a monthly one, where you get everybody together. Yeah. So we have an office in Gurgaon, we have an office in Mumbai, and the two teams are sitting there. And now we have an office there in Bangalore as well. So how do you get all of this team together to kind of create a way where they are able to speak for themselves, whatever they have done in terms of the projects they are driving, the problems they are solving, how they are aligning, what are the challenges, etc. So give them a common platform to connect and kind of showcase their stuff. Yeah, and that's on a monthly basis. But I'm a fan of power of now. So one of the power of now variant on a day-to-day basis is doing the digital DSMs, right? So doing the daily stand-up meetings mm-hmm. at a rigor. So all of my leads, and I try to make them in a group between an IT and a new hires, etc. We do a daily sync up every single day, 30 minutes, etc. I think we do it to a reasonable probability. And then, of course, we have our weekly sync up. So today evening, I have a weekly sync up where we get together and we talk about what's working well and all of that, right? Standard format. So I think that from a communication standpoint, how do you create that daily, weekly, monthly rigor to get them all put together, etc.? I think hiring people in today's world, hiring is going to be a challenge, Ankur. And I think you got to be very, very meticulous when you are hiring. Define the sharper standards on whom to hire, why to hire, etc. Try to hire the best. And most of the time, those best will be better than you. And be very, very... you should want that. There should not be any insecurities. Actually, good. Look, the fresh guys who are coming like 5, 6, 7, 8 years, knowing so much, with such amount of passion, energy. Even if I'm able to imitate their energy, I'm done with, right? I mean, if I'm able to just take a 20% of their energy and able to do my stuff, I'm done with. And that to me is the best part of, you know, hiring and managing people. So, yeah. So, hiring is not going to be easy. Just to summarize, I think hiring is not going to be easy. Again, as I said, I think I took 350, 400 odd interviews to get to my 5, 6 people. But I was very clear saying that I need this thing. And I know I was getting bashed within the organization saying that we just don't have people. You came to me and you asked for these offers, approvals, etc. But you're not able to hire now, which I'm okay with, I'm comfortable with. But I don't want to make a compromise.
You know, it would be interesting to zoom into this new team. What was the composition and how this was brought out in the journey of the last 3 years? Because usually you will prioritize a few things which are, let's say, the most urgent to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you'll find good people and you'll plug them in anyway. So how is this people mapping with the key functions that you had to pull together for this organization? And maybe let's zoom into your part of the organization, because sure. Obviously there is a larger context, but then I'd love to zoom into the whole product itself and say, okay, these are the sort of people we brought in first, then we did this, then we did this, then we did this. What was the broad sequence?
So first to start, as you said, we'll just drill down on the product. We had a product team which was working. Okay, it was not like I just set it up everything, but we definitely augmented it with a lot of new talent. The first big thing was that my entire product or is, for example, slice and dice into some verticals and some horizontals.
Okay.
For example, design and data was horizontal. They were kind of servicing
everyone,
right? And there were a few vertical parts, starting with, say, first of all, core equity B2C.
Mm.
We also have a B2B play. So there is a B2B vertical, there is a B2C vertical within equities. And then within this, also, there are fairly senior PMs, SPMs who are fairly capable and independent. They were brought in. One other thing as a product leader, which I have realized, which is different from travel e-commerce, is that In this kind of a domain, it takes time for people to go and get running. Okay, it's kind of very deeply domain oriented.
Which is what I was going to ask you. Is this a lot of people with a lot of experience, some experience, relevant experience? What kind of profiles do you pick?
So one thing, my promoter, when he was hiring me, and I had, by the way, no experience of trading, right? I was coming from travel. So he said that we have enough domain knowledge. You get the right people, even if you get generic, I think we have the capability that they will...
Domain knowledge, we'll take care of.
Absolutely,
okay.
Absolutely. And knowing Angel, I think that was a trust that, right? At least...
it's not like there was a large supply of people who had a lot of domain knowledge in this side on the tech-first world. So
that also is for sure. There, we have been, I think, again, from the technology side also, we have got few avid traders also as techies, same in product domain. But I think others all have learned on the own. But what we have been very patient is that give them autonomy, give them good problems to solve. And this is a fairly high throughput kind of a domain, right? Because you get spikes during the day expiry, when the market opens, when it expires, right? You have Thursday expiries. So you need to have high throughput systems running. Your uptimes have to be key. Iota of errors has to be much lesser, right? Because you're playing, as I said, with decimals there.
Right? Sure.
And then this was just equity. We had verticals like mutual funds, which just came in.
Which have just emerged
now. We are the second largest in terms of direct mutual fund SIPs, new SIPs being opened. And we have that product just 8-9 months in. Because of the value of now the distribution is coming, right? You have so much footfall on the app, right? So
$2 million is a lot of footfall, clearly.
So this is how I'm saying these verticals were distributed.
So you have product, data and design is horizontal. You had somebody looking at B2C equity, B2B equity. And then what else?
Mutual funds
is a line of product.
Correct.
And these are all somewhat autonomous senior product managers with some degree of not necessarily relevant, but experience to understand
Domain was not process. A, not
domain
so much
expertise
of thing,
not necessarily.
Barring, I would say, few whom we can call it SMEs, subject matter experts.
Sure.
Charting is a very domain expertise thing. For example, it goes into technical analysis. So we have some talent there. Our entire core transactional play becomes very, very key domain stuff. But I think all of this team has been groomed organically, not just
talent. But one of the biggest wins that you would imagine being the customer-friendly user interface or experience that you talk about and tried yourself on will end up being a big shift from traditionally what, you know, a bank's stock app looks like. It's a nightmare from a usability point of view, right? And that's where there's a substantial thrust. And was this a conscious thing that you knew under zero that you had to look at it differently because you come from a very different industry where usability ends up being the deciding factor between app one and app two, right?
No, I think, this has been, by the way, a tough dichotomy. In fact, conundrum. Hai.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look into the personas of our app, okay, the people who are coming in, we have diehard traders. And this is the one, by the way, who have been flourishing on Angel, not just because of new things coming, but they have been probably loyalists.
Sure.
We have a few families whose third generation is trading on Angel.
Okay.
And these could be far younger millennials, right? And then
the first ones had probably called the broker to make that happen.
Absolutely.
The second ones started with the application. The third one is now savvy, started off
Absolutely.
With the app itself. Okay.
The app first. So that's one kind of a base which has been trading regularly, high frequency. They take larger bets and they have been there. Okay. And they are through and through traders. Okay. They know. And then, as I said, the last 3 years, we have been a lot of first timers who will embark on this journey. At some point, they will pick their segments where to trade, where they'll be in derivatives or equity, commodity. They will kind of start. But the starting would be, has to be extremely simple because you can't have barriers there, right? Unless you stick on, you come in. If you are confused what to do, our job is as a product and team, right, to ensure that we have guardrails there, we have hand-holding there, right? So I think all those stitches have been done with this new app. Okay, now it is, it's a same screen where you need to solve for both these kind of
that's only
exchange.
The other studio available.
Correct, that's
which is where the whole strength on usability and staying
Absolutely.
With the team topic till we get to a bit of a conclusion there is that's a primary topic across most mobile app companies, given the amount of time and attention you have is finite. So from the team architecture, you spoke about some horizontal setup and a couple of vertical setups. What was the evolution like? Was it something which you kind of set up as a foundation play that, okay, in my first quarter or two, I need to solve and stabilize this because this is going to become critical for anything else we want to do? Or was it something that, okay, part one, this, solved, and then keep moving while you'll keep building as you go along? How was the team building approach?
Fantastic question there. So I think, as I mentioned, our first word problems were that this data team was set up. Okay. And then whether our instrumentations were right, because I knew that this gestation will go.
And data itself is the last topic,
Absolutely.
Right? Because you will want just the data flows for the app to function, but then there's a lot of analytics and then there is potentially ML and then there's potentially
Correct.
A bunch
Correct.
Of other things you want to do with
Correct.
It.
Correct. I would say that we are still 60-70% there. Today we have got our funnels right. We can capability to monitor is right.
Sure.
We have started doing some AI ML based experiments. We are still early there.
And you know, Ankit, I'm going to keep taking you back to the team topic because when you hired your first data guy, was he a data scientist or a data engineer or a data infra guy, or you know, what would
he
that
was, he was
look
head
like?
Of product analytics.
Head
that
of product.
Exactly,
so it was sort of big top-down sorts.
Absolutely.
And then he built his team ahead.
Correct. We had few analysts then by that time. They were you can say adjacent to the product manager working, but we didn't have a great
An
leader
org,
there.
Org.
Absolutely. So that org inception started happening.
So
and
kind of a similar bet that was taken on you, that you took on somebody who may not have come from the industry but
Absolutely.
Was a good analytics guy, and he became the head of product analytics.
Correct.
So the entire product analytics stack started to get built
Correct.
With him.
In fact, just 3 months back, 2 months back, now we have an entire independent org outside of product. It's called a CDO. Has joined us, Chief Data Officer, which will kind of further groom it. But I'm saying this journey in 2 years.
It's a journey.
Yeah,
which is why, you know, the part that gets very easily glossed over in very quick panel discussion conversations is this level of detailing, right? So product analytics became a critical component for you to solve.
Absolutely.
And now UX and design you mentioned,
Correct.
Which was the other horizontal, but a critical component to solve. What kind of people are these? Where do they come from? What level of experience are we talking about?
For example, our head of analytics joined us from Intuit. Okay. He had worked in banking in US and he had done a master's in US, and then he came in fairly deep And that time, that's why intentionally it was product analytics. It was not data analytics. We wanted to solve the product funnels first.
Sure. Okay?
Now, today, when you can say that you can merge in business analytics and general data, then it becomes like the analytics org, which is like the independent app function.
Mm.
So, first, what problems was, again, with the new app, can we have the instrumentations right? Can we have the capability to monitor things real time? Can we attribute rightly, which is very, very important, right?
Yeah.
First clicks, last clicks. In our space, by the way, what you mentioned, right? These different kind of personas will take different kind of routes
approaches,
to
put their data.
Someone will use charts. Someone will use a watch list. Someone will put an order. Someone, I can, if I'm an investor, probably I'll just go into my portfolio and keep buying more.
Yeah.
Right. So there are different, it's not like a one point attribute. It is the pattern you will follow. Okay, few people will do ABC, others will. So for us, that org was a very, very fundamental org. The second one, as you said, that entirely the design org. We had some outsourcing designs. We had some partners who used to help us. We brought in inline.
Again, you chose to kind of get external expertise because it was hard to hire in-house, or it was like the expertise available?
I would say go to market at that time was for us was
speed.
Important. Speed, and we were banking on with very capable partners again
sure.
who were helping us. But I think lately we built that talent.
Over period, you tend to build this in-house, but you couldn't have done the same thing for product analytics. That had to be done in-house.
Correct.
Design, you could still find somebody else to do it. But the judgment on what's going to work and what's your brief is still all yours. So that the, let's say, high-level ownership is still in-house, but you can get the execution done externally in some sense.
And then the each PM which you mentioned was, these PM have been groomed beautifully. They have been given a lot of autonomy. If I am leading
reports.
So you
brought them in raw, or you know, what was the typical experience of when somebody joined you as a PM?
I think initially it was very overwhelming. I think one thing which we kept interesting with these people was hang on. Okay,
sure.
We are changing. The app is changing, the org is changing, right? And then you are asked to do some re-engineering work, right? Which is almost like reverse engineering what has been
happens.
Running, right? We have some interesting transformations which we did in the last 2 years with these PMs was that monitoring the pulse of our customers. So we have, we also have a customer success program manager.
Okay.
Okay, who runs a horizontal
track. This is a part
track.
Of the
product? Yeah.
Okay.
He runs a horizontal track that all the feedbacks which are coming from all channels. So we have 4 or 5 channels, by the way, and we have been... I would say very astute in now, and I can say very proudly understand what the customer sentiments are from our customers. And for example, we have something called contact ratio, which is simple number of people, unique people who are reaching us inward, denominator of the number of unique users who have transacted in a day.
Okay.
So day on day, you get your contact ratio should move down. Each contact is a cost, right?
Of
each
course.
Contact is a friction for your attention, right? So, and most of the contacts could be because of your product, because of your business, it could be your charges, it could be something from, by the way, we have our humble friend regulators who are product managers for us, right?
Yeah,
this is a heavily regulated space. So this channel of contact, VOCV, we call it voice of customer, which is for all the internal customers, which is with our customer service team. So we have a very close track that all these PMs understand what is going on in their areas for which customers are reaching out. For example, if I'm acquisition, by the way, one of the vertical other pod has been acquisition pod, which I didn't mention.
Within the product org itself.
Within the product org.
So this would be the one that will collaborate the most closely with
absolutely.
The marketing
with the
side
marketing.
Of things.
Absolutely.
So the landing page funnels and the install base and activation
correct.
And all of that. Okay.
And you know, since we are regulated, our KYC has to be with
has
some
be
minimum stops. There
sequence.
Is eKYC, there are some signing, there is
yeah.
some bank checks
yeah.
and blah, blah, you do. Right. So that has been... a great point. We have just incepted 2-3 months back. We have started on dedicated on retention pod also, where we are trying to look into how unstalls, what's going around. There is some lifetime value for our customers, right? And we have also taken, since we are moving to a super app kind of a model, which our latest campaigns talks about
sure.
that, we will have some new products coming in, just not direct mutual funds. We may have lending coming in tomorrow. We may have insurance and we may be selling FDs and so on and so forth. So we have.
You know, I'm going to ask you some probably basic question, but is that retention pod and acquisition pod horizontal or vertical?
To me, this is vertical. Okay. There is a handshake where your acquisition will kind of leave it.
But
and then
your acquisition is largely driven in one particular category, two categories, or how does that predominantly work?
Okay, so that way, I think it's from a product talk, I will say it's vertical. But yeah, when you acquire a customer, obviously you acquire for all the stuff. See, I would say that way also it's still vertical, but we at some point it will become horizontal because we have been
imagine.
An equity player. Okay,
so
today when we acquire, we don't acquire for a dedicatedly say for lending or mutual
fund, but somebody comes in for equity.
At some point we will.
So the whole cross-pollination will become, I think, a charter for your retention guy to cross-sell, upsell,
absolutely,
whatever.
Absolutely.
But the acquisition collaborator in the product side is ensuring that the inbound funnels of whatever traffic is coming in is converting and activating in the most effective way possible. Right. So that's a more horizontal play in some sense, and I wonder if it'll get vertical at some point. But more important than that, it's a lender being the retention guy to now look at cross-pollination of all shapes and sizes to say the entry point was equity investment. Mm-hmm. But now this guy can potentially be a valuable user for all of these
all
things.
All other asset classes.
And from that lens, the size of this org will be a proportion of what are the different things you're looking to offer and how many segments are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in some sense. So what I see in terms of your journey, your analytics came in, your design kind of brought in subsequently. It was partly outsourced for a bit in between. Then you had a customer service side of interfacing where people would know what's happening on the pulse of the customer. Then now you're talking about the acquisition part, and then you're talking about the retention part. And this is where the evolution is being. What is the size of the org, if you can just put that number in perspective?
We have close to 400 plus tech team.
Okay.
I have close to 50 plus PMs.
Hmm.
And these are, I'm just talking about PMs. We
sure.
have close to 20 plus design team, close to 23 exactly, precisely.
So 50 PMs, 23 designers, 400 engineers,
we have
all of it goes to making that
correct.
App work.
And we have analytics of close to 30 plus,
okay,
which is part of the data org now.
And analytics, which is now this is going to go beyond the product analytics.
It'll balloon.
But product analytics will also merge with the data.
Correct. Now we'll have obviously some bit of data integration layer. Mm-hmm. We'll have AI ML layer. We'll have ML ops. So
sure.
That'll have its own charter. One thing just to add on,
mm-hmm.
when I was saying on the customer track side, right? We had the customer success program
mm-hmm.
manager. So we have these 4-5 channels. One I told you as VOC.
Sure.
The second one is the NPS. We have been, I think, one of the few orgs which has been able to crack, because there are no public numbers on NPS, right? You will see in some blog somewhere that
yeah.
NPS is. And obviously, there are US stats, like say Netflix NPS would be, say, 60 plus. At that point, the flywheel will start rotating, right? People will start referring automatically.
Sure. The word of
retention.
Help matters.
Absolutely. So we have, without disclosing the absolute, but we started from abysmal low. So, and we have this, I think we have cracked that algo well, that we have something called touchpoint score. Okay, because we have different journeys, right?
Sure.
So if you are a chart user, we'll prompt you at some point through our campaigns or through a native nudge kind of a platform which we've built in internally, that how do you like this?
Okay.
And if you obviously rate us as a detractor, we'll try to get a reason. Just the two questions.
Mm.
So this aggregate of these TPS, and these TPS are now being prompt, say once in X days frequency, 60, 90, so that we don't bother you, but you
sure.
still, you can rate
it's
us.
Again skill, it's still a lot of feedback that will come in every day.
Absolutely. Mm. So across, say, close to 10 precise journeys, we will ping you.
Mm.
And aggregate of this will become your NPS. Okay. This touch point score will lead to a net promoter score. This net promoter score, what we have realized is that over a period now, while it will fluctuate on one day or other day, but the broad aggregate trend is a very good pulse of how your customers are doing.
So this
gives us almost like, it keeps us on our toes. If you have a review, which is a detractor who has actually not liked this, we will immediately get a pulse. And all these PMs, including myself, I think we have this charter that we look this granularly week on week.
Okay.
And I think we have a fantastic trend there. We disclose in our public results being a listed entity that how it's inching north. So that's second one. Third one is the entire feedback on App Store and Play Store, which is a common...
Which is a public information,
currency.
But
correct.
It's a good pulse, sure.
Correct, absolutely. Today, we are rated around close to 4.3 on Play Store, 4.1 on App Store. And if you look into historically, we have come a long way. In fact, during the migration, there was a time when we were looking into dip because a lot of the loyalists were not liking right what we are doing. We holded our fort, and I think that's
we came around.
And the fourth one has been the way that we reach out, right? Just very recently, we did some workshops. We continue to, being a B2B and B2C mix, we continue going feet on street. We go down, we keep meeting our traders, what they are doing, our partners. We have a decent, in the B2B team, we have a decent BMs, business managers who are, who keeps giving us what is going on in the pulse, right? So we take all this, filter it, harmonize this, and constantly, I think this goes into the roadmap. So I think that has been honestly a challenge as a product leader, that you take a customer problem, you also take into a business problem, you take a revenue initiative, and that's how do you squeeze in your...
And then you finally prioritize it, because
absolutely.
Ultimately the engineering bandwidth will be what it will be. Digital transformation involves integrating third-party systems into existing ones for a holistic operation.
Additionally, there are also the build versus buy decision-making gap. How do these two leaders architect that? Find out.
Technology resources are always going to be scarce, which means you will want to put them on stuff which is genuinely core to your business slash unavailable outside. But how are you making these choices at this point?
So I think the way I look at most of these is that I'll take a transactional approach to things, and then I always look at more from a mid to long term per se, right? So transactional, which is where we most of the time get caught up, saying that, look, this business need, that business need, that business need. And then we look at from a vision standpoint, from another 1 to 3 year or 5 year standpoint, saying that this is what exactly we'll be needing from what is the transactional ask could actually meaning something here in a 1 to 3 or 1 to 5 year kind of a time frame. So while you evaluate solutions and options, I think that one first principle basis evaluation always helps, which says that, look, let's say if you are trying to solve for a, and I'll take very specific and yet very generic example. Let's say you want to solve for a CRM. Yeah, a CRM is a very, very standard tool. Now, a CRM would lead into a couple of these existing platform level solutions from Microsoft, from Salesforce, from other partners. And then there will always be a, you know, an itch of building all of that in-house, etc. Now, the question that you need to ask from a CRM is not about what a CRM as a capability provide, right? I mean, that would be, of course, one part of the way a product lead or a tech engineer would evaluate from a features and from a scale and from a NFR per se. But what you need to understand is that from a customer experience per se, what is CRM end of the day? End of the day, CRM would lead into driving the customer experience and ensuring that how you are able to ensure a predictable customer experience across your set of customers, right? Mm. So now the question would be that what are your fundamental asks on customer experience, right? And what is that you want to build with that customer experience? List that down, right? And it's important to just keep making it sharper, clearer, saying that, look, you want to ensure, for example, you want to ensure that 95% of our request happen with an NPS of 90, yeah? And let's say the TAT of closing is less than 24 hours, right? And then you start making that sharper, et cetera, because this is exactly what we are looking at to build from a customer experience standpoint. Now, the moment you do that, you know very clearly that if you are looking at from an output standpoint, these are my key output metrics that I'm going to chase, right? What are the features and what are the ways and means of getting there? And that's another way of now the next level, which is where now you start saying that, look, tell me the features, tell me the functionalities which help me build this workflow, which helps me then arrive to NPS of 95%.
Sure.
Tell me the features, functionalities, the workflows, and of course the adoption, depending on the UI, UX, interfaces, etc. to tell me how do I reach to a TAT of less than 24 hours. Right? Now, again, I'm giving some broad metrics, but the idea is to arrive to a framework where you are able to say that from an output standpoint, from a business output standpoint, if customer experience is your key forte against which you are evaluating a CRM, then how are you arriving to the features, functionalities, which will give you the right KPIs?
Now that you talk about a fairly comprehensively laid out end state and then working backwards from there, my trouble typically with this kind of scenarios is how do you deal with agility in this kind of context? Because you will end up discovering a year from now that, okay, what you set out a year ago was this much, now you need this much more. So when you're doing this comprehensive one-time initial end state exercise, how do you keep room for flexibility and agility?
No, absolutely. It's a very good point as well. I think the way to look at this would be always to evaluate, to say that, look, I took a CRM, right? So end of the day, look at the overall scheme of things from a completeness per se, right? And where exactly this thing is fitting, because CRM is just going to be a single bit. And I know we are talking CRM, but it's not relevant.
That's okay, you can pick up any other category, same thing.
But the idea is that CRM is such a CRM or any other platform
like
is such
a central
thing. So, okay, now with CRM, again, this is a little digressing towards more of a architecture kind of a discussion. But it's very, very relevant because that architecture decision will actually going to decide the agility of your business down the line. Now, of course, with CRM, there will be some delta that you will need to keep updating and improvising, right? So, is your CRM flexible enough of, number one, giving you that control and that agility to incrementally, keep giving you the features, etc.? And there could be multiple ways. One way to say that for most of these developer-friendly platform on CRM, they will give you an enterprise platform and they will also give you an agility to say that, look, you can always increment these codes, write your own piece of code on top of this, right? And you can keep improvising that. Now, that is one way of that. So, if you have that and if you vetted that particular proposition, that is good. But I would always say that if that is what you're looking at, please do vet. Don't just come back with a theoretical point of view saying that, look, ye to ho gaya ji, ye to ho jayega aise. No, not ho jayega aise. If that is the ho jayega aise, let me just quickly vet what exactly this means. The other way to look at from an agility standpoint is that in your overall scheme of things, are your internal or external applications or your complete stack tied up directly to your CRM? Mm-hmm. So, I can still use a CRM, but I can still use it in a more decoupled way. Yeah, mm-hmm. Which essentially means that my systems are going to talk to my internal system. It's going to be a middleware or your MDM or something equivalent, right? But I'm at the back of it, I'm using a CRM. So tomorrow, if I want to, let's say, change that by any ways and means, everything else is agnostic. Of course, I need to ensure that the quantum of what that CRM was providing to the middleware, etc., that integration layer is sorted and there's a backward compatibility there. But then I know very clearly that my systems are not directly integrated. So the first and very most thing that we are trying to do here in our scheme of things is to say that, look, from a control and agility standpoint, it's going to be the middleware who drives and connects everything. It can't be that you have a direct stitching between independent systems. It can't be. It has to be, even if they are simple, even if they are just, let's say, two microservices, three microservices, they still have to route through the rightful middleware. It could be a proxy pass even. Again, getting more technical. It could
You're
be a proxy.
This as an upfront heavy lifting exercise to be more flexible in future.
Correct. Again, as I said, the architecture and the platform level capability arise because of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If I'm building a platform, my platform core capability is saying that my architecture is built in a way that tomorrow if I want to add or update any new microservices, it's only relevant to that particular integration, not anything else.
So, you know, one of the things we've learned across previous conversations is the choice between a monolithic stack versus an assembled stack. Because larger comprehensive software vendors which have had supposedly integrated solutions are not necessarily the best at everything they do. They're great at some of these things. And now what we've seen people make the choice, and we've had this in previous conversations, is they end up assembling, okay, this is good for this, this is good for this, this is good for this. What you seem to be doing is one more level above that, okay, this is good for this, but I'm not going to let this talk to everything else directly. I will put my layer in between so that tomorrow to replace this, this is not going to disrupt anything for me.
Correct. No, I think I'm doing it, just to extend that, I'm even doing it double-clicking both of them.
Hmm.
So from an overall architecture standpoint, from a high-level integration standpoint, ensuring that, look, the middleware and the corresponding integrations are driven through that, right? That's one. Number two, I'm not also very, very enthu about getting each of these systems separately, right? And that's the choice I always try to make. Mm. And you know, as you said, right, I would love to have the heavy lifting done today for each of those systems. So for example, let's say if I am looking at a marketing automation platform, and I would typically know that my marketing automation requirement are these right now, but for 3 to 5 years, depending on the business progression, of course, business will progress. What are the next 5, 6, 7, 8 things that I will be requiring?
Mm.
And for that to happen, for example, a very simple thing. For example, let's say, is my marketing automation platform providing me the right clickstream data, which I can then leverage in my big data platform and start making more scientific models to engage customer, personalize, all of that, right? And these capability I may not require from, let's say, another 6 months per se, which is fine. But then, of course, I require that. So my question always has been about, number one, even if you're choosing a certain set of platform, question what exactly it provides and question the extension of that from next 1 to 3 years per se, if not more. I think 1 to 3 years has been a sweet spot. I would say in today's world, 1 to 2 years is becoming a sweet spot because things are changing so fast.
Yeah.
So that's one. Number two, I think from an overall transformation standpoint, the leaders have to be very, very conscious of the number of platforms or number of third-party integrations you are doing. If there are just too many, you may like to take a stab to that as well. Because down the line, while it looks very sexy to say that, look, I've got a great middleware and everything else is just beyond that, all of that. But the fact remains, when rubber hits the road, your team is getting sucked up in solving for these third-party 1, third-party 2, third-party 3, third-party 4. Because when rubber hits the road, it's not going to be your ideal workflow that you have built, right? When rubber hits the road, you actually start seeing, you know, what things you miss, what are the new nuances, what are the new business use case, the agility, the flexibility, all the whims and fancy you promised your business stakeholders in the initial days, right? So you've got to be very cautious and clear and sharp about getting the right full platform and try to see if you can consolidate most of that. Mm. Try to see if you are not able to overly, you know, get everything as you want. Yeah.
So which is where it gets complicated and interesting at the same time. That where do you draw the line on how many is too many in terms of the number of different tools that you bring together? And in some sense, if you consolidate too much, then you're also compromising in some sense. So where do you see that appropriate balance? I'm sure this is subjective and business context driven, but in your case, if you have addressed this, how have you looked at this?
So if I just take a step back and I look at my day-to-day operations, right? And the easiest way to do is to just scan my emails over the last 30 days or 90 days and see through, just club them into various different categories, saying sure. that, look, where exactly am I getting the largest discussion happening? Now, if I would be, and let me say that if I found those scans, right? So I would say, let's say, operational, ABC operational is one bit, XYZ e-commerce is another bit, and then ABC chain management is another bit, yeah? So, if you are able to clearly understand and foresee that your larger chunks from an operational standpoint would be this bit, which is, let's say, for example, your service operations are going to be the most dynamic one, and which is where you would need a lot of agility, a lot of control, a lot of dynamism. Because while you are solving for that right now, you know very clearly that this is going to evolve and this is going to be direct consumer facing. So the amount of dynamics it will have will also be paramount versus something like, let's say, a financial controlled workflow. Yeah, mm-hmm. Which once built would remain
largely stable
and uniform, hopefully, mm-hmm. over the next 6 months or year or so. So if that is what you have found, then the idea should be that now this is the platform which is where this particular business use case or a workflow is getting served. Now, what is the agility there? Do I have a complete control there? Mm. Am I working with one partner or is it my in-house? Or I'm working with 3, 4, 5 partners?
Mm.
Now, the moment if you tell me that it is more than one, if that service operation bit is critical to me and I have to work with more than one partner, now that would be a
Red flag sort of thing.
Mm. And then I'll start challenging that while you may be solving that for the interim, mm. are you going to stick to that going to persist the way forward?
Mm.
So the way to look at that, if the dynamic and agility is there, try to consolidate, get all of that into one.
Is core versus non-core the right framework to look
core
at?
Core versus non-core. You have to define your core. See, the important thing is, Ankur, that these core and non-core also changes, right? Because transformation journey, mm-hmm. my core right now is something, but let's say another 6 months, 9 months, I got something done, dusted, etc. Now, immediately shifts to the mm-hmm. non-core. Mm-hmm. But I think the important thing would be that in a transformation kind of a setup, it's very easy to get caught up into so many cores at a time, right? So it's also, and while we talked about the whole architecture and tech evaluation, etc., there also has to be a business side of things where you say that, look, let's understand what is our core. Let's not start solving. While you may need to do a lot of things in parallel, but at a point in time, let's ensure that from a focus standpoint, what are one or two key areas we are solving? And you solve it really, really well.
Hmm.
The amount of parallelism and the amount of sequencing, etc., has to be discussed, decided within the team, because what we easily forget today is that it's not only the product tech outcome which determines the transformation. It is the change management. It is the Absolutely. Adoption. It is the way to perceive that way forward on using that particular product and taking it through.
I'm going to get a little bit on the technology stack side of things in terms of what are the support ecosystem that you put together through this journey. So you have to do product analytics, you have to have a product platform which is going to enable you to do this. Some of it might also mean build versus buy conversations because you've mm-hmm. seen enough of that journey as a tech leader across mm-hmm. your previous avatars. Mm-hmm. So did you choose to build anything from scratch? Okay, this is, you mentioned the whole nudge bit mm-hmm. had to be built in-house because maybe there Absolutely. Was no external solution that would solve the problem. So what was this broad evolution like in terms of the pieces of the puzzle that you brought together?
Interesting. So I think, yeah, as I mentioned, it has been, assembled kind of a play, not...
I think that's become the most common practice now, assemble it the way you care about.
Correct. Something you built in. Our entire Clickstream, for example, we have built in all ourselves.
Okay.
We don't use any...
The entire Clickstream you're capturing yourself.
Absolutely.
And it's dashboarded in-house.
Absolutely.
Wow, okay.
The visualization is on Tableau, on Amazon really? Cloud, we have pretty much...
You'll embarrass a bunch of these product analytics tools, but okay, this is impressive.
We are on Redshift, on the warehousing front.
Sure.
We have entire pipelines which we have set up. We have the best in class, I think, on the cloud, mm-hmm. which manages it within the analytics. The entire tech stack, by the way, we have revamped. The entire backends have been rewritten in Golang on the engineering front.
Was this like an approach when you came in that we'll build an MVP first, get rolling, and then keep expanding from there? Or was this something you already knew that this is how it has to be done? So we build it right for the first time.
I think we went for the second one. We knew that it has to be done in this way. And I think we have been, good thing with the new rollout has been now, Ankur, is that our capability to experiment has gone far better.
Of course, that's the underlying infra that's available.
Absolutely,
to
right. The entire, we have almost like the entire mutual fund, if you access within Angel, it's all almost like a trusted web app we call TWA, one of the best performing apps in the industry by Google standards also.
Sure.
So we have few native play, we have few trusted web app play, we have few screens on Flutter, I think, yeah. So that's
it's all been choices made consciously.
And I think we continue evolving. There also, I think, what would be, as I mentioned, with the STARS framework, I think we need swiftness and reliability are, I think, two very key aspects.
Yeah, which becomes interesting because a lot of times in the interest of speed versus, in some sense, quality, mm-hmm. sometimes people do tend to take quality for a toss that, okay, we'll rebuild it when we have to. But right now, we're in a very aggressive competitive situation, so we have to get this out in a certain time frame. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with these decisions?
A very tough one, honestly. I think there is always a pressure that, can you do it?
Yeah, right? I mean, I want it tomorrow. Correct. Or maybe yesterday, right?
I think so. There also, it's a mix and match. Few of our tracks within the company, I would say, are, for example, the entire, we call it a new NBU, new business units which are coming in. They are relatively more agile.
It's like a SWAT team which will turn things around fast within their world.
Correct. There is a bit of matrix structure there. The product was very keenly with business. Business has a hand on how prioritizing, because they need to ship out faster. The sprints could be a lot more shorter in cycle.
Sure.
On the other side, on equity, for example, in this year after migration, we have been trying to become more predictable and more planned. Okay. So we are trying to literally, few people joke that this becomes like a large IT service company, but we feel that this is how it is needed because we have done that something. And
sure.
During migration, we were like shipping every 15 days. But now, since we have a very decent large base, you can't surprise them every other day, right? And regression becomes a very big problem in kind of our kind of play. When you have a predictability, it means that things should work.
Yeah.
It's okay if you don't ship something for maybe 15 days, that's okay. But once you have shipped something, probably it has to work.
It has to be a way more reliable.
Absolutely.
Than...
Correct. I think we are coming into that stage where we would be, I think, much more smarter with our ABs. Our experimenting frameworks will come in. Still, I would say not there 100%, but those things, I think, you will see, I think, more and more on our apps coming in. So I think this side of equity, it's almost like we have gone into very, very granularly how we plan our sprints.
The evolution also, I mean, there's only so much more that you can do with that specific experience.
Absolutely.
In some sense. And the additional components wherein the new products are going to come in is where probably the new space to experiment will lie. That's where I would imagine you'll not experiment in the entire base. You'll take a small little subset.
Absolutely.
And you'll do something with it.
Correct.
Make it work and then expand further.
Correct.
From there.
And that's why on this predictable side, I think, on the stable side, we need to be as product, as tech, as analytics, we need to be predictable. Can we bring a foresight that when we release this, it's almost like the PRD, if I write, it should say that this should be able to move this matrix. There has to be a lead indicator by this percent. Because it may be utterly wrong. We will monitor it, obviously, after 15 years. But the art and science of writing it that way and giving that right gumption look is very, very needed in this much. On the other side, I think you can iterate and faster and you can fail faster. I think that's,
so in
that's
some sense, you have like multiple product dogs now running within the larger org, because this is stable, steady ship going. Don't tinker with it too much because the room to mess up is very little. You have pretty much zero room. This is experimental space. You're going to work with a small audience. You can play with it a little bit here and there. But I mean, obviously, within the boundaries of maintaining the brand reputation. It's a very trust-built kind of a category overall. And I wonder how forgiving people are to some of these situations when things don't work out. Did you ever have a downtime situation where a critical hour in the market in your app is not working and you had to deal with it?
No, big time. Actually, we have it. We had it. There are so many, I think, players beyond your app, which are could be unforeseen, right? Dependencies,
yeah.
Right? You have depositories like CDSLs. You have KRA agencies. You have Exchange itself, right? then obviously our humble SEBI is there, right?
Of course.
The big daddy. So I think, yeah, there could be ecosystems which can fall flat. So I think that's where I think we are also trying to become more resilient. Hmm. Do we have backup services, right? Do we have redundancies of that? Our internal play on just the notifying capability, right, of turning around a bad sequence of events and bringing it up, surfacing it early with a probably, if not great accuracy, to say a majority accuracy that, okay, this has gone down, it will come up in this much time, this service is not there. I think that's where we are trying to go deeper.
Lots of pieces of the puzzle to be put together. I think the size of the puzzle keeps expanding in some sense. Absolutely. Because there's always more.
But what you just said, right? We are roasted, I think, on that way. If you go to our Play Store reviews, and anytime something is in this ecosystem is not working, obviously that.
Nature of the game. It's a high stakes game. It's a high involvement affair for most people who are using the platform.
That's why reliability continues to be a very, very thick of this stack. Awesome. One more other thing which we have kind of helping us to iterate faster, even on this side of which is the core balance side, which you said, right? The equity side is that we revamped our entire web platform. And we feel that the desktop trading, right? Because these are heavy traders, okay? And you have large real estate there, right? Be it on charts, be it you have to look into watchlist parameters. So we have revamped that along with the app, and sure, now we are seeing a great traction there.
What's your broad split between desktop versus mobile in terms of DAO, let's say?
Close to almost like our 80-85% is, by the way, Android, 10% is iOS, and 5-6% is...
That's super small, but very aggressive.
But they're very sticky, right? Mm. And interesting part is that the consumer behavior there says that while I may not trade from web, but I will probably open it as a second screen and watch it, and then...
Well, it's something like it's always on, right? Absolutely. For some people, it's a second screen which is there, which you'll keep watching all the time.
Correct. So I think that's where we feel that all the... mature pro trading fraternity can actually utilize that more and more, and because this overall funnel will kind of grow,
keep growing,
right? So I
it's a power user in some sense.
Absolutely.
Got a little bit about the people side of things, a little bit about the tech side of things. Maybe there is room to go a little deeper in the tech. Is there anything that you made a choice, or okay, this is a piece of tech which we need to invest in upfront, and you build some of the analytics stuff in-house already? But apart from that, there are more tech pieces that get involved, right? So there would be, let's say, a data lake that you would have brought in. The amount of data you're dealing with is insane. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a cost question that this much of data is going to cost so much and we need to rethink this or something of that nature? How do you deal with this?
I think that way, again, the entire, I would say, management again has been, we were very pro 2 years back. I think we shifted a lot of our stuff to cloud.
Okay. Yeah.
SEBI guardrails, we need to have something on-prem. The core trading can't move in there.
Sure.
But all the ancillary stuff has been now on cloud. We are supposed to be having excellent backup strategy. We are DR.
Data retention as well as backups.
Correct.
And those are regulated, so you can't kind of do much about it.
So we have just upgraded our infra, that side. We have moved to a better data center. The earlier one was plagued with a lot of legacy stuff. Right? So I think those things are also play a very, very important role.
In your reliability factor, right?
Absolutely.
If data centers, if they go down, you're like, okay, correct, nothing can be done.
We are dependent on our order management / risk management system, which are third-party systems which interact with the last mile layer with the exchange. So we are ensuring that we are attempting to write that off our own. Today it's kind of a universal player which supports also. Yeah, this core equity to support, I think, is a very technically, you can say, challenging stack with this scale.
That's also where you're choosing to replace some parts of the pipe that you have with the external ecosystem in some sense.
Okay.
But you have the appetite to do that now because everything else is sort of stabilized and the equity team can afford to invest time in some of these other components.
Now, that was an interesting explosion of insights into the tech aspect of navigating a digital transformation journey. On one hand, Shubham spoke at length about integrating systems via middleware, what we expect from a tech partner, while on the other side, Ankit is more interested in building an assembled tech. Actually, come to think of it, both of them are saying somewhat the same thing. This cues me to the next important part, data.
And there's this whole subject of data in terms of capturing it, surfacing it, dashboarding it, and decisioning from it. How does that play in your scheme of things?
See, data is fundamental, as I said. I mean, you can have multiple provers, right? Data is oil, data is this, data democratization, ABC, XYZ. So I'm saying data is very simple. End of the day, the fundamental to all of these transformation is baseline is data. You have to, number one, ensure that the quality of the data and the quantum of data is all captured in the system, structured, unstructured, etc., etc. So the foremost point being that the quality of that data, which is coming through multiple integration, leaking here and there, etc., has to be nuanced and well understood, and the capability of ensuring that you're able to ingest all the quantum data with the right structure, with the right quality, etc., that to me is paramount. And somewhere, what I've seen is that people get more interested in building the platform because there's a, it looks so, right? I mean, it's the rightful spirit of building the right tech platform with big data capability, etc., etc. But from an outcome standpoint, the core lies in ensuring that you're getting the right data, right? Because if, let's say your systems are mammoth and they have been legacy, etc., in our case, for example, how do you ensure that you are able to capture each and every single workflow-led data or the clickstream data that way in an offline world and able to capture it properly in a structure in the rightful, unstructured way? Yeah. So that to me is paramount. Once you've got that capability in, how do you then leverage ensuring that we've got the data now in play? How do we ensure the decisions maker? How do you enable the rightful? The first and foremost would be to say that now that we've got the data, how do you reflect this data into key outcomes which the business users can use and make decisions or drive on a day-to-day basis? So for me at least, and again, this was a little more on a software, rigor side, that it actually took me a couple of months to just arrive to a state where the business stakeholders actually start using that particular platform. Okay. Because my understanding was that they're already using, and, sure. and I was given to that because, you know what, these guys are the one who are coming back their requirements and giving to the team saying that, look, this is the format I want, and, and all of the various BI platform, etc. And they are getting delivered and they're getting done with. But what I really, what I was constantly, of course, seeing in different set of reviews, etc., that they are referring some Excels, etc., in different format, shape and form. So I thought maybe they would have kind of done some dump and would have played with that data, etc. But then when I actually started validating each of that, I found that they found they're still using the old ways of consuming that data and using that, because of course that was a more of a habit thing and a more comforting thing. So the first starting point for me was to say that now that we've got the data platform, now we got that stabilized, now that we got that basic capability in play, and we're also delivering some of these fundamental decision-making KPIs, input, output, etc. At length and breadth, right? So we just kind of scaled it so that there's no excuse on saying that, look, this data is not available and that's why we're using something else.
Sure.
Yeah, so ensure and drive that in totality to enable the whole data aspect from a business outcome person. Now, that to me was the very, very first thing. Hygiene, again, in today's world, but important to let that happen as a starting point. Yeah. Number two was that now that you've got this data, how do you start making more, more sharper sense from a decision-making we talked about, but can now this data start making sense from a buying journey, from an engaging journey, from a D2C standpoint? And similarly, can this data also then help your service operation team to optimize for their workflows, etc., right? So that is where the whole ability on building some sort of a computation models or AI or machine learning models, which can leverage that data and start building some of these features. Similarly, with things which like an IoT and all of those coming, how do you then enable that amount of stream data and kind of capture that into your setup, etc., which is what is again a fun and a forward-looking thing that how do you create the rightful big data platform on capturing IoT data and kind of create the right computation ways to solve for it? A little different from what you would have on a big data setup because the initial layers on MQTT and the firmware pushing that data, etc., are two, three new things that you need to integrate and work with. But by and large, the backend remains the same. So how do you build that capability again on solving the machine learning or computation-led solutioning? So we got one person to drive the overall bit on
leading the engineering side.
This is on the business side.
Okay.
To ensure that the decision making, right? So you got the data, etc., in play. Now, how do you ensure that the folks on the business side are using that data? So that ownership of saying that, look, this person who's in your team is the one who's leading all of this charter. While he is getting all of that done with the engineering team or product team, etc., but he's the guy who's front leading those requirements, those asks, etc. So that becomes a decision maker. Or is a person who drives all of that, then you better leverage him and drive that adoption and democratization, so to say.
Handshake between engineering and business from a data standpoint.
Data science.
So whatever has to be surfaced, whatever has to be utilized on the decision-making side of things.
Yeah.
So from an org perspective, you have the product guy, the engineering guy, and now also this data guy who interfaces with business. Business is the one accountable for revenue, I would imagine, or growth.
Yeah.
And that the whole thing gets stitched up.
On the MarTech side of things, then there's this whole term called CDP, and then there is all of those things that support the advertising side of things, and then there is this whole campaign management, and then there is engagement data coming in. How does that look for you?
Pretty interesting. So I think, we are also in our phase of enriching our CDP. We already started this journey quite long back, I think 3 years, with when I mentioned that our instrumentation has started coming into play. So this has started enriching. Today we have close to... I think close to 400 metadata each customer, which we kind of aggregate.
All the 15 million KYCs that you have.
Correct. I think it's a long way. Be it your, as you said, starting signals of all the way from KYC, or what you have given to us.
Sure.
Your first trade data, how do you behave on the app? Like,
the whole clickstream, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Correct. And this is very interesting, right? Because we have very swinging personas, right? On one day, as I mentioned, you will be doing X things. Other day, you will become probably an investor. Our core goal is that you keep engaged and horizontally you spread your wings, right? You should have a stock SIP also. You should have a mutual fund SIP also. You should trade also, correct? And that's how you'll be more sticky and engaged, right? So you have, I think, huge number of data points coming in.
Yeah. This.
I would say we are still at a stage we will just start leveraging this. Today we are in terms of augmenting this into our CDP. Entire post-trade bit is very, very interesting for us. We have seen a lot of anxiety in the customers when after the trade, right? Post-trade funnel, right? How is my reports? During taxation season, there would be a deluge of people who are looking for, is my P&L plus, minus, long-term capital gain, short-term capital gain. If you're an intraday trader, you have a day P&L which is coming, right? The entire bit of, though we are into discount trading, still people will figure out, right? How much they are paying us versus they are actually, there is government taxes like STT, statutory charges. So all this leads to a lot of, earlier it used to be, I would say, not by design, but by the simple lack of, I think, bringing it on the app because of real estate and usability. I think now it has become very, very transparent. Thanks to the regulators also, it has become transparent. So I think that funnel started working very well. And as a result, we see our customer interactions on those queries have also started reducing. This also helps us in long-term retention.
Operational efficiency as well.
Operational efficiency, right? So this I think, is all knitting together well.
So in terms of bringing all of this data together and enriching your CDP is... In some sense, you've gotten phase one, phase two sorted, but there's still more work to be done. But are there data sources which are not coming in for your CDP yet and that's okay to wait for a certain time? What would those be?
I think, for example, just the inception of now new products and we need to tie it, right? For example, if you have come in and you have done a mutual fund SIP and you've been doing it for X days, as you said, right, at what point we should start upselling you, cross-selling you, right? Should we nudge you on equity now, later? Or the other way, right?
So all this orchestration choices, you know, what I was curious more about right now is, you know, what happens a lot of times is when somebody imagines a CDP, this seems like a behemoth of a project, right? Mm-hmm. They'll have to have all of these data sources together, and then it has to come in, it has to stitch together nicely, it has to start to make sense, I have to do segmentation, analytics on top of it, then perhaps create my first campaign. So in that sense, the whole time to value seems like really far off.
Well,
what I'm trying to understand better is there a room to kind of close smaller loops to say that, okay, you get this stuff in, you do this with it, there's some sort of outcome, some sort of output value created, and then you can keep expanding that scope. How do you see that?
I think the answer is somewhere in the middle, as you said, right? You have some quick wins. For example, if we are collecting, say 40 attributes around your portfolio or 30 attributes, right? A simple, use case from the CDP could be that whether you're, when you are exiting if you're a positional trader and if you're exiting your portfolio and you are about to do that in say 300 days versus 365 days, your entire 15% versus 10% would have actually made a difference of 5%. I'm saying now short-term gain versus long-term gain. Now that's a very cool hack, right?
Yeah.
Just the data tells you, right, that please don't do it on X day. You should have done it X, Y, and Y. Now, similarly, if your portfolio is considered very biased towards say one kind of segment, say you only invest in IT, okay, but the banking is probably doing well. Right. So this is portfolio diversification.
So in some sense, what I hear you do is a lot of analytics on top of the raw attributes you've collected and put a bunch of derived attributes to the user.
Absolutely.
And that seems to be a large part of the CDP play in that sense that you have all of this raw information. I mean, you have to collect that data and to process it to answer the fact that he's an IT preferred
buyer because it might not show up in the raw attributes to begin with. Absolutely. And likewise, more behavioral
and likewise, parameters. These are quick and small wins while you do the stitching, as you said, for a longer. See, the CDP should ultimately able to tell me your persona is actually.
Everything.
But that's like a...
It's an ongoing journey. Ongoing right? It will keep expanding.
Correct.
I don't know if I make one trade, can you be able to, will you be able to tell me my risk appetite? You won't be. But if I do 10, maybe you will be. And then that's where the whole maturity is an evolving game. But the room for quick wins exists in is what I was trying to establish. That, okay, if you can do something with the initial set of data you have, there's always room to put that in execution. Because what tends to happen is, you know, whenever these, generally what we're seeing these large implementations of new MarTech and new CDP stacks, it's a year-long project. By the time you get to anything which is meaty, you've already lost track of what you probably originally started out with. In some cases, the companies have had even longer implementation timeframes, which means the team that actually started this whole project seems to have moved on, which ends up becoming like a whole question mark on the MarTech subject itself, that is this worth our while? And to me, that's like a big waste because there's so much you could do with just maybe a quarter bit of some integration in some sense, right?
And with that, we've come to the end of this Common Threads episode of the State of Retention Marketing podcast. I would love to know your thoughts. Do you really like the blend? Do write to us at sormpodcast@webengage.com with questions, ideas, and suggestions. We'd love to hear from you. Before you go, do subscribe to the podcast so you never miss on the latest and greatest drops. This is your host, Ankur, signing off.